Mostly clear tonight, lows in the low 50s, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs 75 to 80, slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Looking ahead to Thursday, sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. The Bemidji Senior Center hosts a Medicare presentation Wednesday, September 3rd at 1 p.m. Learn about the plans available before open enrollment, which begins October 15th. Thanks for choosing KAXC this afternoon. More news is next.
Military as law enforcement is a last resort, not a first.
With talks of sending the National Guard into more cities, how much can the president legally deploy the military for law enforcement outside of D.C.?
Today is Tuesday, August 26th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, we hear from one lawmaker about a plan to redraw congressional maps in Missouri and the impact it'll have on constituents.
If you guys proceed in doing this, understand that you're going to need to dig three graves, one for yourselves, one for the Democrats, and one for the Republic.
Also, we all know what a really hot summer feels like, but do you know what it sounds like?
One New Orleans musician breaks it down for us.
We've had hot summers, especially growing up here, like during the summer, you expect it to get hot. But now it feels like the sun is like right above us.
And flesh-eating screwworms, what?
Ew, first this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. A federal judge has dismissed an unusual lawsuit filed by the Justice Department against the entire federal bench in Maryland. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports a Trump administration sued to challenge an order that barred the immediate removal of detained migrants.
In its lawsuit, the Trump administration says the District of Maryland federal court exceeded its authority and violated the law when it put in place a temporary freeze on deportations of any migrant who filed a petition challenging their detention. The administration said the pause amounted to judicial interference in executive branch prerogatives. Because all 15 federal district court judges in Maryland were named as defendants in the civil lawsuit, a federal judge in Virginia, Trump appointee Thomas Cullen, was tapped to oversee the case. Now Cullen has dismissed the administration's lawsuit. He says to do otherwise would break with overwhelming legal precedent and constitutional tradition, as well as offend the rule of law. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
A Wisconsin judge accused of helping a man evade federal immigration agents has lost a bid to get the charges dropped. A federal judge said today that Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan cannot claim immunity, upholding a magistrate's ruling that the case against her should proceed. Dugan was arrested in April. President Trump held a more than three-hour cabinet meeting today, in which he highlighted his crime-fighting efforts in Washington, D.C.
Over the last 13 days, we've worked so hard. We've taken so many. There are many left, but we've taken so many criminals, over 1,000.
Trump said his decision to employ National Guard troops and federal law enforcement agents on the streets of D.C. has made the nation's capital safe. Democrats are pushing back against Trump's threat to send Guard troops to other cities. They say it's a political movement to intimidate opponents. A pill version of a new obesity weight loss drug has cleared a clinical hurdle, paving the way for its maker, Eli Lilly, to apply to bring it to market. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports the results showed notable weight loss among those able to tolerate its side effects.
The experimental drug is called orforglipron, and it could be the first pill form of GLP-1 medications to be approved for weight loss. In trials, the highest dose of the drug showed about a 10% reduction in body weight over about 16 months. Pills are cheaper to make, and patients prefer them over injections. However, Eli Lilly's trials also show, at the highest dose, over a tenth of participants quit the study citing side effects like nausea, vomiting, and other gastrointestinal problems. The company can now seek regulatory approval to sell the drug worldwide. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News. The Israeli military says the Palestinian journalists who were killed in yesterday's strike on southern Gaza's largest hospital were not targeted. The military issued a statement today saying the back-to-back strikes were aimed at what the military believed was a surveillance camera that Hamas was using to monitor Israeli forces. International leaders and rights groups are condemning the attack. A wildly popular animated Netflix movie about a fictitious all-girl rock band's battle against evil spirits is set to become Netflix's most watched best original film ever. And NPR's Chloe Veltman reports a soundtrack to K-pop Demon Hunters has already broken a record.
The K-pop Demon Hunters soundtrack is the first soundtrack ever to generate four simultaneous top 10 hits in the Billboard Hot 100 chart's long history. It's undeniably catchy. Sean Robbins is Fandango's director of movie analytics. With the film's creators in talks about a potential sequel, Robbins says Demon Hunters could become a major franchise.
It could be merchandise, it could be theme parks, more soundtracks.
Streaming giant Netflix even took the unusual step this past weekend of screening the film in nearly 1,800 movie theaters around the country. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
The launch window for SpaceX's huge Starship rocket opens later this hour. This latest test, Starship's 10th, has been delayed twice. SpaceX says a liquid oxygen leak led to the delay of Sunday's attempt. Cloudy weather got in the way of last night's blastoff. I'm Jael Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It's 5:06. Support comes from the 17th Annual Community Connect, Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing information on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. More info can be found by dialing 211. Clear skies tonight, lows in the low 50s, mostly sunny tomorrow, highs 75 to 80, slight chance of rain in the afternoon.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Here's the thing. President Trump is allowed to send in the National Guard and federal law enforcement and, in a sense, borrow the police force of Washington, D.C., because the nation's capital is a special legal case. While the District of Columbia mostly does govern itself like any other big city, federal law allows the president and Congress to override local control in certain ways, regardless of whether any D.C. residents actually believe that there is a crime emergency in D.C., as President Trump says. It does get harder to legally justify his actions if he wants to target other major cities, like Chicago.
Chicago's a mess. You have an incompetent mayor, grossly incompetent, and we'll straighten that one out probably next. That'll be our next one after this.
But what does federal law say about taking this federal crackdown on crime on the road, beyond the District of Columbia? Well, for that, we have called again on Steve Vladek, Georgetown University law professor. Welcome back.
Thanks, also great to be with you.
So let's just talk about the military component of all of this right now. It's been a little over, 2 weeks since President Trump deployed the National Guard in Washington, D.C. What is the legal authority for that?
I mean, so there really are two different authorities he's relying upon. With regard to the D.C. National Guard, so the folks who are here in D.C. all year, the president is always the commander-in-chief of the D.C. National Guard. He can use them at any time. He doesn't need anyone's permission. But he's also relied upon out-of-state National Guard troops that have been sent by a bunch of red state governors under a really obscure and not well-tested authority that was enacted by Congress in 2006. It's really that authority that's a much bigger deal if President Trump really does try to take the show on the road.
And Trump has said that his decision to deploy any National Guard troops is to fight crime, even though D.C. police data shows a double-digit drop in violent crime rates the last few years. What is the National Guard allowed to do when it comes to local crime?
This is where things get really, really sticky because of the uniqueness of D.C. Mm-hmm. In D.C., the National Guard has much broader power than it has almost anywhere else in the country, because in D.C., it is always federal. It's always acting under the command and control of President Trump.
Right.
In other states, in California, in Illinois, in New York, the only way President Trump could directly command the National Guard would be to formally federalize it. And that depends upon President Trump finding various things to be true on the ground that also don't appear to be true on the ground. And that would expose whatever he would try to, I think, a significant risk of litigation.
Okay. What happens to the president's authority to federalize the National Guard in parts of the country outside of D.C. when there is local pushback? Like here in Los Angeles, where I am, all the pushback from the mayor here and the governor did not stop Trump from federalizing the California National Guard and sending active duty Marines into L.A. earlier this year. And now Trump is saying more cities like Baltimore, like Chicago are next, but mayors of both of those cities and the governors there are saying no. So what allows the president to disregard the wishes of those officials?
Federal law since at least 1807 has allowed the president in some circumstances to send troops into states whether or not the governor consents. And, you know, we saw that put to good use a lot during the civil rights movement. For example, when President Eisenhower sent troops into Little Rock, Arkansas to, you know, desegregate Central High School. The tricky part here is that what President Trump did earlier this year in California was based on his assertion that the federal forces were necessary to defend federal property and federal personnel, to wit, ICE officers who were going on raids in Los Angeles. He needs that kind of a target. He needs that kind of a sort of predicate or some broader argument that local civilian authorities have been unable to enforce the laws on the books before the law would allow him to federalize, say, the Illinois National Guard and send it into Chicago.
What specific legal arguments could city and state leaders make to challenge the Trump administration in court?
So, you know, again, I think there are two different authorities he could use, and the arguments will depend upon which one it is. So if President Trump tries to federalize, let's say, again, the Illinois National Guard, just as one example.
Yeah.
One of the arguments will be that the factual predicates for federalization are not present, that, you know, he didn't have the authority because there was just no need for it. Another argument, and one we've seen in the California case already, is that even if President Trump has the authority to federalize the Illinois National Guard, he doesn't have the authority to send them into the streets to do ordinary law enforcement, that they can only do limited missions like protecting federal property or federal officers. If it's the other authority, if it is the, you know, weird 2006 statute that allows state governors to send their National Guards at their own volition into other states to support a, quote, federal mission, unquote, then I think the arguments are going to be that you have to have the consent of the receiving state governor, or else you have a massive violation of the equality of states' rights under the Constitution.
Well, just historically speaking, for context here, explain why the U.S. has always tried to draw some clear lines between the military and domestic law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, if we go all the way back to the founding of this country, you know, one of the charges against King George III that was leveled in the Declaration of Independence was that he was using, you know, the military to effectively supplant civilian rule in the colonies. This is why, for example, the Constitution prohibits the quartering of troops in our homes in the Third Amendment. Congress really, since 1792, has said we recognize there are going to be some circumstances, some emergencies in which the president's really going to need to be able to use troops on the home front, maybe to repel invaders or to suppress an insurrection. But, you know, those authorities have historically been used sparingly. We haven't even seen those authorities used since 1992, when President Bush, you know, used the statute called the Insurrection Act to send troops into Los Angeles during the Rodney King riots. For President Trump to cross that line in a context in which there is such significant contestation of the factual basis, and in which it really does seem to be about partisan politics and not public safety, you know, is not just challenging those legal precedents. It really is challenging the very, very strong norm we have in this country that we don't have the military doing law enforcement.
Well, short of the courts, is there anything stopping the President of the United States from declaring an ongoing emergency and leaving troops on the streets of D.C. indefinitely?
So not on the statutes as they are currently written. Now, you know, someone has to pay for all of this. So presumably there is going to be a budgetary constraint at some point along the way. But, you know, for better or for worse, and I would argue for worse, Congress has given the president an awful lot of power over the District of Columbia, you know, reflecting a series of historical and structural quirks about the nation's capital, I think the most important point for folks to take away from that is that doesn't mean that the same things will be legal if and when President Trump tries them in other cities. You know, just because we're getting conditioned to and desensitized to visuals of National Guard troops in Union Station and on the National Mall doesn't mean we should feel the same if you see that in, you know, Times Square or Grant Park.
Steve Vladeck of Georgetown University Law Center, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Two members of Congress visited Syria this week, a Republican and a Democrat. They say they want to give Syria's new government a chance to rebuild after a devastating civil war that ended when longtime ruler Bashar al-Assad was ousted last year. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports that the lawmakers say it's time for the U.S. to repeal sanctions to give Syria a chance.
Senator Jean Shaheen, the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, says she was impressed by Syria's new president, who met with her at the palace where ousted leader Bashar al-Assad once ruled over Syria.
So it was quite opulent on a huge hill overlooking the city.
The new leader, a former jihadi fighter, Ahmed al-Shara, showed her the view from his private office.
This was an interesting reflection of how he feels about the Syrian people. He says he gets up in the morning and the first thing he does is look out over the city of Damascus. And the last thing he does at night is look out over the city of Damascus because he knows how much there is to do.
It was a scene that also made a big impression on Congressman Joe Wilson, a Republican from South Carolina. He, too, has had a long interest in Syria.
In fact, I had such an interest in dictator Assad. Last November, he identified me as an enemy of the state. So I was very happy that he fled to Moscow 3 weeks later.
What Syria needs now, Wilson says, is the chance to rebuild. And that means lifting U.S. sanctions, which should unlock foreign investment.
We need to fulfill what President Donald Trump has said. Give Syria a chance.
But there are many skeptics in the U.S. and in Israel, especially after deadly clashes last month between Syrian forces and the Druze minority in southern Syria, close to the border with Israel. Israel launched airstrikes in response, even hitting close to that Damascus palace where Shaheen and Wilson met with al-Shara. Israel, which has vowed to protect the Druze, doesn't trust al-Shara, who a year ago had a $10 million U.S. bounty on his head for his past links to al-Qaeda. Senator Shaheen tells NPR that if she were to choose a president of Syria, it would be someone with experience in democracy.
But that's not where we are. Where we are is with a president who has overthrown a dictator that nobody thought was going to be able to be overthrown.
And it's a government that needs help if Syria is to remain a unified country.
It's a nascent central government. And I think it's important for us to do everything we can to ensure that that government continues to move forward in a positive way. And I hope that Israel will be supportive of that as well.
President Trump has waived sanctions that were meant to punish Assad's atrocities during the Syrian civil war. Shaheen is now sponsoring legislation in the Senate to fully repeal the sanctions. Congressman Wilson is doing the same in the House. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
You can tune in weekday mornings at 9:45 for our slice of green cheese and Saturday nights from 7 to 9. Green Cheese Trivia, your hosts this week, Justine Jacobson and Shannon Antola. It is 519. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to KAXC. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde. Available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed, Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, Sundays 11 to 4. There's more ahead from All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE.
For NPR, comes from this station. And from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Missouri could be the next state to redraw its congressional maps. The governor has not yet called for a special session on redistricting, but President Trump posted on Truth Social that, quote, Missouri is in. He's urging Republican states to redraw their district lines to give Republican candidates an edge in next year's elections for Congress. Now, Missouri has 8 congressional seats. 2 are held by Democrats, including Representative Emanuel Cleaver. His district includes Kansas City, and he is with us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
Congressman, you've represented that district since 2005. Before that, you were mayor of Kansas City for 8 years. When you saw President Trump's Truth Social post asserting that Missouri is in, what was your first thought?
Well, I thought that, you know, this might be one of the president's statements that he will sometimes offer to the public without any connection to reality. But I also had been in contact with friends and family in Texas, and they were all very, very sure they were going to redistrict mid-decade in Texas. And so I then realized that Missouri could very well be next. Mm.
My colleague Jason Rosenbaum with St. Louis Public Radio spoke with Missouri Congressman Bob Onder, who is a Republican from the St. Louis suburbs, and they talked about why Republicans want to redistrict. Let's take a listen to what he said.
We are a Republican state. Republicans have supermajorities in the Missouri House and the Missouri Senate. Republicans hold all of our statewide elected offices, including, of course, governor. And I believe that we should pass a congressional map that reflects the values of the state of Missouri.
Congressman Cleaver, your response to that?
You know, one of the painful things for me is that the Missouri delegation has been maybe the only delegation in Congress that has been able to meet. We've been meeting for 20 years. Once a month on a Wednesday, we all sit down and have lunch together and work together. And so this kind of thing, unfortunately and painfully to me, and unknowingly painful to the state, is beginning to tear that uniqueness apart.
Congressman, then what do you make when you see states, I'll use California as an example, that are redistricting in order to attempt to gain Democratic seats, to create 5 additional Democratic seats in the example of California? Is that the wrong approach here?
Well, I'm not sure yet. I think history will have to make the ultimate decision. But I think Governor Newsom is right to say, okay, we're going to fight back. And so right now, the Democratic Party will use the Republican overreach to ignite a fire to the spirit of America that will only be extinguished by the retreat of what I call political absolutism. Now, there's a danger, fighting fire with fire, because we have to keep in mind that fighting fire with fire will eventually result in a nation of rubble and alienation and sometimes even decimation. So I've said to some of my Republican colleagues, if you guys proceed in doing this, understand that you're going to need to dig three graves, one for yourselves, one for the Democrats, and one for the Republic.
Acknowledging that Governor Kehoe has not yet called a special session or made any announcements about redistricting, I wonder, as this conversation has been going on, given what we've seen happening in other parts of the country, including Texas, including California, what are you hearing from your constituents in Kansas City? What did they have to say about this?
They are furious, and it's not just Democrats. I think this is key. I've actually felt pretty good over the fact that institutions, some of them lean Republican. They are not holding back that this is divisive and could also hurt in the representation that the people of Kansas City would normally receive.
Now, some might remember that your district was targeted for redistricting back in 2022, and that effort, it ultimately failed when state Republicans worried that redrawing district lines could backfire and perhaps put adjoining Republican-leaning districts at risk. Do you think that Missouri state Republicans have overcome those concerns?
No, I think there are some concerns. Look, you put water in a balloon and you squeeze it, the water's going to go someplace. Let's say you take 10,000 African-American Democrats out of Kansas City and put them in one of the adjoining districts. That member of Congress is not going to be happy.
Last question, Congressman. If Republicans in your state of Missouri do redraw your district as a Republican-leaning district, will you seek re-election again?
I'm going to have to look at that and think about it. As of this very moment, I am running and not considering retirement.
Congressman Emanuel Cleaver of Missouri, a Democrat. Congressman, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
The U.S. has confirmed its first human case of New World screwworm. It's a flesh-eating parasite that typically attacks livestock. For decades, it's largely been contained to South America. But as NPR's Rachel Treisman reports, cases are creeping closer to the U.S. border.
A Maryland resident who returned from El Salvador earlier this month brought back a rare flesh-eating parasite. Federal health officials said this week it is the country's first human case of a New World screwworm infection. The screwworm is a tropical blowfly that's found in parts of South America and the Caribbean. It's unique in that it lays its eggs on living hosts, usually livestock or other animals.
They're looking for a wound or another sort of entry point, like nasal cavity or the ears, to lay their eggs.
That's Max Scott, an entomology professor at North Carolina State University.
Females can lay up to like 200 eggs at a time.
And when the eggs hatch into larvae,
they eat the animal alive.
Human cases are rare. They're not contagious and can be treated. State health officials say the Maryland resident has recovered and the public health risk is low. Here's Philip Kaufman of the entomology department at Texas A&M University.
It is certainly a greater threat to our livestock industry and wildlife populations than it is to humans.
That's especially true in the U.S., which eradicated screwworm in the 1960s. Scientists produced billions of flies, sterilized them with radiation, and dropped them from airplanes. They mated with female screwworms, and the population dropped. Here's Scott again.
Over a 50-year period, screwworm was pushed back from the United States to the Panama-Colombia border, then was held for a long time until the barrier broke.
Screwworm cases have been spreading north since 2023, reaching Mexico last year. In response, the U.S. has paused live cattle imports across its southern border. This month, the USDA announced it will build its own sterile fly production facility in Texas. It will join an existing facility in Panama and another set to open in Mexico next year, Kaufman says.
When we eradicated the fly the first time, we had plants that were producing anywhere from 500 to 700 million flies per week. And right now we are maxed out at about 110 million flies per week.
The U.S. plant may not open for several years. Kaufman says the technique will work. It just needs more flies to work faster. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Mostly clear tonight, lows in the low 50s, and for tomorrow, mostly sunny, high 75 to 80, slight chance of rain in the afternoon. And looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. You can answer our question of the week. What were your favorite books to read as a child? Text us 218-326-1234.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The Minnesota Department of Health has confirmed 20 cases of West Nile virus so far this year. Of those 20 cases, two people have died. Citing the recent increase, health officials urge Minnesotans to take precautions. West Nile virus is transmitted to people through the bite of an infected mosquito. Less than 1% of people bitten by an infected mosquito develop encephalitis or meningitis, and symptoms usually show up within 1 to 2 weeks. Elderly patients and those with weakened immune systems are at greatest risk for severe disease, followed by people who work outside or participate in outdoor activities. The highest risk areas for West Nile include the agricultural regions of western and central Minnesota, but cases of West Nile virus disease have been found throughout the state. Precautions against mosquito bites include using insect repellents that contain up to 30% DEET, pre-treating clothing and gear with permethrin products, and being extra cautious at dawn and dusk, the peak feeding time for mosquitoes from July to September. Two citizens are suing Itasca County leadership over alleged federal civil rights violations. Megan Buffington has more.
At last week's county board meeting, former Commissioner Doug Carpenter served all five current commissioners, Attorney Jacob Fotchold and Administrator Brett Skiles. Auditor-Treasurer Austin Rowling and Sheriff Joe Dasovich are also being sued. Here's Carpenter serving Commissioner Terry Snyder in ICTV's meeting recording.
And least of all, you've told me that I should do things properly, and here I am.
Thank you, Doug.
Here's your paper.
Robert Preble and John Casper allege that the leaders are violating the 1st, 4th, and 14th Amendments and the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. They say the county has suppressed their negative public input, selectively enforced policies, failed to respond to data requests, and illegally prevented anonymous requests. Preble previously ran for county commissioner in two different districts. He addressed the board last week.
Let's be honest. This board has broken the trust of the very people it's sworn the oath to serve. For months, we submitted comments under your own policy, and you ignored them. We called, we emailed, we texted, and you would not respond.
Preble and Casper are asking the court to declare their rights have been violated, force the county to fulfill their data requests and offer anonymous comment, and to award compensatory damages. Administrator Skiles briefly addressed the comments, which he says he doesn't often do.
And I certainly won't respond to all the inaccuracies presented today. I would just point and see, look at this. I can't even get through one. I listened to his, what I would describe as character assassination, and
Robert's
he speaks
rule.
Out from the order. It's my floor right now. But I would just advise or invite any citizen who would like to have honest answers on those questions, please feel free to send me an email. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
All public information.
Commissioner Larry Hopkins said he appreciated Preble and two others for presenting public input because it doesn't happen often. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
Around $7 billion in federal education funds will be restored after a multi-state lawsuit over the Trump administration's decision to freeze the funds in June. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison joined more than 20 other states in suing the administration, calling the funding freezes on six long-standing programs, quote, unconstitutional, unlawful, and arbitrary. On Tuesday, Ellison announced that the lawsuit will be dismissed, with stipulations that the remaining funds would be released by October 3rd. Most of the $74 million in education funds frozen in Minnesota were released by July 25th. Minnesota and other states have used these federal education funds for after-school and summer learning programs, programs for migrant and English as a second language learners, and teacher training. Construction on Highway 53 for the Eveleth and Rock Ridge transportation improvements is making progress, with the project expected to be complete in October. Beginning Wednesday, traffic will be moved back onto Highway 53 off of the detour route. Drivers can expect lane shifts and areas of head-to-head traffic. The roundabout at Progress Parkway will also open Wednesday, providing access to the schools ahead of the start of classes. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. From Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing the number 27-MEDICARE. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump says that he is firing Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook from the board of the central bank, alleging that she committed mortgage fraud. Cook says he does not have the authority to fire her and says that she will not resign. Her lawyer announced he will be filing a lawsuit to challenge this dismissal. It's the latest escalation in President Trump's battle for greater control over the Fed, which is meant to be an independent government agency. But is it even legal for the president to fire Lisa Cook? Well, to help us answer that question, we're going to talk to Catherine Judge. She's a law professor at Columbia University who focuses on financial regulation. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what does the law exactly say about a sitting president's ability to fire someone from the Fed?
So there's two different issues here. First is the statutory scheme. And what that says is that the president can only fire a governor of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve for cause. And the aim here by Congress was to make sure the Fed had the independence it needed to take a longer-term view when it fights inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a bunch of Supreme Court cases that have been bubbling up recently about the president's authority under Article 2. So how much prerogative does he have to choose who is an officer of the United States in his administration? And the Supreme Court has taken a very aggressive approach to Article 2 and a very broad reading of executive authority.
Uh-huh.
But it has said the Fed is different. So it looks like that he actually has to show that there's a causal reason, a good reason for firing Governor Cook.
Okay, well, what do you think as a lawyer? Does the president have cause in this case? These mortgage fraud allegations haven't been proven out, right?
They're serious allegations, but in terms of actually having a basis for firing her, right now it's dubious. Again, the context here matters a lot. We know it was very recently that he was trying to fire Jay Powell on the basis of the cost overruns of a renovation.
Right.
He has continually attacked the Fed for its interest rate policy. And so that context makes a big difference, and it adds a heightened suspicion, particularly given the fact that he's provided no due process. She's had no opportunity to be heard, no opportunity to present her side of the case.
Right. We should remind people that Cook has not been indicted or charged with anything. She has not replied in detail to the actual allegations. So what happens now in terms of those allegations?
So she is bringing a claim that she has the right to hold on to her job. And there is this big question over what is the due process that she is owed? Because ultimately, it doesn't mean much to say a president can only fire a governor for cause if all he has to do is make some allegations and then dismiss her without there being any process where she gets to say, here's my side of the story, before she is actually dismissed.
You have mentioned that the president has already repeatedly threatened to remove the chair of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, in this campaign to get the central bank to lower interest rates. Can you just step back and explain to people what is at stake here in terms of the Fed's independence?
The Fed's independence has already been incredibly compromised by not just the repeated attacks by President Trump, but his effort to claim the right to remove, this is the second governor, without really having a solid foundation and without being willing to go through a process to show that he has adequately shown that he has a right to remove the individual in question.
So, as someone who thinks regularly about the importance of financial regulation, how concerned are you about this entire situation?
I'm incredibly concerned. The law plays a very important role helping to protect the independence of the Federal Reserve, but the law alone has never sufficed to protect central bank independence. It's always required some degree of good faith on other actors in government. And if we have a president who is absolutely determined to make sure that the Federal Reserve is under his thumb, eventually he is likely to succeed, regardless of how this particular claim plays out. And that's going to have significant costs for the long-term health of the economy.
Catherine Judge of Columbia Law School, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Like many parts of the country, New Orleans is getting hotter. You can see that in the data, feel it in the air, and hear it in the music, as Drew Hawkins with the Gulf States Newsroom reports.
Danovan Calhoun Bettis is our musician guide, and he's about as New Orleans as it gets.
Music, background, church, school, marching.
Your whole life?
Whole life. Yeah.
The 35-year-old says his passion hasn't changed, but when he's marching in parades around the city, the heat is different.
It's way worse. And we've had hot summers, especially growing up here, like during the summer. You expect it to get hot. But now, it feels like the sun is, like, right above us.
We'll get back to Bettis and his music in a sec. But first, let's talk about the heat data.
It's levels that we've never seen before.
Jen Brady is with Climate Central, an independent research group. She says climate change is driving temperatures up at a faster and faster rate. Since 1970, the average summer temperature in New Orleans has gone up by more than 4 degrees to around 85 degrees Fahrenheit. But Brady says just looking at that increase on a spreadsheet, it might not look like much. That's why showing what the data means is important.
Some people like a map. Some people like a bar chart. Some people like music.
So let's look at the data using music. I asked our musician guide, Bettis, and his band, Bettis and Third Degree, to help us out.
All right.
Also, we're doing that's the slowest version.
So they're playing a song called Joe Avery's Blues. It's a classic second line song in New Orleans. It's played in parades and for special events like funerals. So I want you to pay attention to the tempo, the speed. Using beats per minute, what you're hearing represents the first 75 years or so of average annual temperature data. But by the 1980s, the temperature starts to go up more quickly. Between 1980 and 2000, the average annual temperature in New Orleans goes up by more than a quarter of a degree. And it may not seem like much if you're just looking at the data in a spreadsheet, but it is significant. And between 2000 and 2015, it jumps up again, almost a full degree warmer than the first 75 years of data. This is where things really start to pick up. Over the last decade, the temperature increase has accelerated even more, almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit more than the 1980s. And many climate scientists say temperatures are increasing faster. So in addition to being a professional musician, Bettis is also what's known in New Orleans as a culture bearer, someone who preserves and maintains the city's unique traditions. He says the heat affects everything, especially in the summer.
I don't even see what the preventative measures are or could be to, like, continue the culture the way we do it and still not, like, pass out or, you know, be in sweltering heat the entire time.
So for now, musicians in New Orleans, like Bettis and his band, try to take gigs later in the day and stay hydrated. For NPR News, I'm Drew Hawkins in New Orleans.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Jenny Slate has taken on a number of beloved roles in everything from Parks and Recreation to Obvious Child to Marcel the Shell. Now she has earned her first Emmy nomination for her role in Dying for Sex. Last year, she joined Rachel Martin on NPR's Wildcard podcast. And at the end of every episode, Rachel invites the guest to take a trip on the show's memory time machine. Here's Rachel to explain.
So, in this memory time machine, you choose one moment from your past that you would like to go back to. It is not a moment you want to change anything about. We're not changing things. It's just a moment you'd like to linger in a little longer.
I'll tell you the first thing in my head is my grandmother's really ugly couch in Quincy, Massachusetts. And she had these side tables, you know, one that nestles under the other. Mm-hmm. And she would have those paper towels, like, that are so soft and thick, you know? Like, not the environmentally good ones that we use now.
The other ones.
That are like, these are paper, never forget. But, like, the ones that are like, this is basically a washcloth. My grandmother, Rochelle, being at her house in Quincy, Massachusetts, and she would make us a sandwich of, and again, this doesn't age well, it was the 80s, Wonder Bread and margarine. You do not need teeth to eat it. And she would put each the side tables in front of us, and we would watch Nickelodeon. And we didn't have cable at our house. And it was just so sad. Honestly, I miss my grandmother so much, but sorry. Yeah. But just deeply peaceful, and like the first feeling of unconditional love is from my grandmother, Rochelle. She was so weird and strange and really, really traumatized by the Holocaust. And she never let any of that spike us, you know, like we were aware that she was deep inside of something. My sisters and I think it was like, oh, Nana is, she goes into something. She's not really like other adults. She's trustworthy. She'll drive the car. She can really give really great baths, you know, really good food. But she's living in two different places, and she surfaces to be with us. Yeah. And I just remember sitting there with her in all her complexity and having this soft sandwich that we would never be allowed to have at home, no crusts, you know, watching Nickelodeon people get like the gloop on them, that's like the slime, mm-hmm. and just being like, I mean, I wouldn't have said this as a kid, but like, I love this. Like, I want this forever. I cannot believe that I don't have that anymore. And yeah. I just love it. It feels so good to think about it.
It feels good to have been able to visit that with you. That's such a lovely memory. That's a beautiful memory.
And to hear more trips on the Memory Time Machine, you can listen to Wildcard with Rachel Martin wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. 7 o'clock, Will Owens, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music, and there's more great music at 10 o'clock on Headwaters with DJ Dang. Support for KAXE comes from Klocko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 7 years now. Their taproom is open Monday through Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday, noon to 6. More info at klockobrewing.com. KAXE has built connections between listeners, community organizations, and local businesses in northern Minnesota since 1976. You can consider becoming a business sponsor to help KAXE build strong connections now and into the future. Text the word sponsor to 218-326-1234. Thanks so much for your support. United Way of 1000 Lakes has many volunteer opportunities in Itasca County. Find a list and sign up at volunteer.uwlakes.org. And you can learn all about bats at the Sac Sim Bog this Saturday from 5:30 to 9 p.m. There will be both indoor and outdoor portions of this presentation. Registration is required. Learn more at saczim.org/events. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. There is more ahead from All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The end of summer is normally the time of year when doctors and pharmacists start to suggest vaccinations for viruses like flu and COVID based on federal recommendations. But this year's very different. With Robert F. Kennedy Jr. leading the Department of Health and Human Services, the process and guidance have changed significantly over the objections of many doctors and epidemiologists. Now, some state public health officials are considering how they might collaborate to issue their own public health guidance. Dr. Robbie Goldstein is the commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, and he's one of the leaders of that effort. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks for having me.
What do you make of the changes to the CDC's vaccine recommendations this year?
You know, I think so far what we've seen out of CDC is minor changes that they have been making throughout the summer, but they're adding up to pretty significant changes to our vaccine policy here in America. I think in particular, what we've seen is a direct attack on some of the types of vaccines that we use in this country, including mRNA vaccines and specific diseases that we know are important to protect against, but yet are being called into question by the current federal administration. In particular, I want to call out COVID-19.
And so that's one of the reasons that you pulled together this group of public health leaders from across 8 states in the Northeast to start a conversation about possible collaboration. Explain how that would work. How would this region issue public health guidance when the CDC has public health guidance that might conflict with it?
Well, I want to first say that states have always traditionally put out their own guidance for their own states to make sure that the information that we're sharing resonates with our communities and the people that live in our states. So we're not necessarily doing anything different this year. What we are doing is we're coming together proactively. And we're making a commitment to do this process transparently and together. And we think by doing so, we'll help build trust in the recommendations that we put out. And we'll also make sure that we're protecting as many people as possible across the Northeast.
That question of trust seems really foundational here. Do you run the risk of muddying the waters if, for example, the CDC says healthy people over the age of 18 don't all need to get a new COVID shot, and yet Massachusetts and 7 other states say healthy people over the age of 18 do need to get a COVID shot, to take a hypothetical?
Well, I think trust is really built through conversation and through transparency. And so if we in the Northeast come together and share our data publicly, I do think we can build trust, even if our recommendations are different than what we see out of the federal government. I also hope that what we're doing here in the Northeast might be an example that we could set for others across the country, and certainly for the federal government. But how they can use data and how they can present those data transparently in their decision-making process.
Does this ultimately lead to a future where you have one set of health policies for red states and another for blue states, no matter who's in charge at the federal level? Because you could imagine a scenario where a Democratic HHS secretary endorses a vaccine that public health appointees in Texas or Florida might oppose.
Well, I certainly hope that doesn't happen, and that is not our intention with the Northeast Collaborative. I'll note for folks that In the Northeast, we have Democrats and Republicans, including Democratic and Republican governors and state legislators. We're coming together not based on partisan politics, but we're coming together rather because of science and evidence.
I know you said this is not political, but for so many decades, Democrats have said the federal government is acting in your best interests, while Republicans have said, listen to us at the state level. It really does seem like the tables have turned, that you're now saying people shouldn't necessarily trust the federal government's guidance. Trust us, the state appointees, instead.
It may feel that way, but so much has changed in the past 9 months that this feels like a necessity. It feels as if we have to shift in this way. The reason that historically Democrats may have pointed to the federal government and to the guidance is that we could believe in that guidance. We knew that that guidance, those recommendations, were based in fact. That's just not the case now. We oftentimes see decisions being made by a tweet or a post on Truth Social, decisions in public health being made by a video posted to YouTube. That's not the system that we've existed in before, and so it requires us to change our tactics.
What's at stake? What are the risks here?
I think, you know, if we don't rely on the evidence, if we don't use data to drive our decisions, we will see people get sick. We'll see the health of our communities fail. We'll see our hospitals fill with people who have vaccine-preventable diseases. And I don't think we have to look too far into the future to see that. If we take a look just this past year at what happened in West Texas with a measles outbreak spreading to many other states in the region and other countries, that's what happens when we don't use evidence and data to drive the recommendation. In the case of measles, we know that the measles vaccine is safe and effective, but that message didn't come clearly from the federal government.
Dr. Robbie Goldstein is commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, a lot of little girls dream about being a mermaid. I mean, I still do. And for a lucky few, living that dream does become real. At Weekiwachee Springs State Park in Florida, that's about an hour north of Tampa, young women have been performing shows as mermaids since the 1940s. Recently, a group of women who performed back in the 1960s relived their aquatic days. Sky LeBron from member station WUSF was there and has this audio postcard.
Arlene Brooks and Mary Jo McCoy are becoming mermaids again. They're 75 and 76 years old. It's a bit tougher for Brooks to shimmy into her costume these days.
How hard is it to put on the tail?
I've got a messed up knee, got messed up stomach, got messed up arm. It's hard.
Okay, now come over here to the ladder.
But when Brooks and McCoy get back in the water,
it's like you never left. It's magical. It feels like you're at home again.
There's a feel to it. There's a lightness. And when you're at my age and it's 17, there's really no comparison. But when I get back in that water, it's all there, every last bit of it. I'm weightless. I'm young. I'm pretty. I'm having a good time.
That good time was thanks to a Wish of a Lifetime program from the AARP, which sponsored five former Weekiwachee mermaids between 75 and 79 years old to see if they still had the chops.
Was it easy to get back into the routine? Have you guys done older routines that you did before? Like, what's that all been like?
No routines. We're just trying to see if we remember how to get down, how to hold our breath.
How's it been working so far?
So-so.
It's harder than you might think. They're swimming in a spring, not a pool, with a current they're fighting the entire time.
Has there been anything that you've carried through the rest of your lives because of this job and because of this experience?
Got mermaids all over my house. My husband said if I brought another mermaid home, he was going to kill me.
Does that drive to keep on swimming ever stick with you? You ever just want to jump in a lake and be a mermaid again?
I live in Arcadia, Florida, and occasionally I throw my tail on when I'm feeling especially crazy. And I swim around the pool, and everybody comes out and takes a look and says, oh, yeah, Arlene's a mermaid. I am.
And Brooks told me, once a mermaid, always a mermaid. And after meeting these women, I'm convinced it's true. For NPR News, I'm Sky LeBron in Weekiwachee, Florida.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive, Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education, at edutopia.org. From Odoo, maker of all-in-one management software with the goal of being simple to use for all employees. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. And you can find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-3 326-1234. Thanks for your support.